All right, let's turn to Isaiah chapter 6. This will be my 14th time to teach the Bible in the last 2 weeks. But the first time that I haven't had to speak through a translator, so like in like little short sentences and stuff, so I got a little pent up English ready to roll. So in the mid-2000s, the Living Hope, so this in case you aren't aware, we have just made 8 years since we merged Sherwood Baptist and Living Hope Fellowship together, and so that's fantastic. Also, on the Living Hope side of it, it's been 20 years since we launched as a church plant, so this is momentous in different ways. And a part of that, the Living Hope story, we used to work with these churches in Mexico, and it started off as college ministry trips and then kind of morphed into something where we had a partner church down there, and we would travel a couple times a year and take groups and like jump into their community. And there was one trip where they were like, we were working in a city called Monclova, and they said, we're going to spend a couple of days working at our mission church, which is like 45 minutes away. So we drive out there, and it's this beautiful part of Mexico, just mountains everywhere, or what we would call mountains. People in Colorado would not call these mountains, but we would call them mountains. And we're driving through, and we turn off this road, and we go drive into the most like quaint, beautiful little sleepy town called La Madrid. And some of you know exactly where I'm talking about. And it's like this little planned community. Like it's got streets. It's like a grid, but it's like you go back in time. Like everything is very, very relaxed. And you can kind of just walk the streets, and you hear like music playing on the radio somewhere, and you also hear like roosters crowing, and like there's just like incredible. There's no light pollution, so at night you see all these stars. But it's in the valley that literally has mountains all around it. And so we go out there, and we're a bunch of Louisiana people, so we're just like, this is the most beautiful thing ever. I can't imagine getting to live surrounded by all these mountains. And so I can remember us like talking with some of the people that live there and just trying to get to know them a little bit. And I just couldn't get over the mountains. And like, that's kind of one of my things. And so I would compliment people as if they had something to do with the mountains. So I was like, congratulations on the mountains. But I would just affirm like how beautiful the town was. And I would always bring up these mountains, and over again, you get the same response. So they were like, what? Like the mountains. And they're like, oh, yeah, good mountains. You know, like they're good mountains. And I just kind of began to realize like, oh, like they don't think they're as special as we do. Like we think these are incredibly special. But to them, the mountains just, it's a part of the background, you know. They had lived surrounded by beauty so much that it had stopped being beautiful to them. And I remembered that, and of like, for some reason I held on to it. Maybe it's just for this season of Lent. Maybe that's the reason that God had let me hang on to that, because it is very possible for us as the people of God to walk with God faithfully and to learn more and more and more, and we to grow in like depth and in our understanding of God and who He is, who we are, what the gospel is, to become so like immersed in that world and confident in it and growing that it can become too familiar with us. And we maybe have our own version, a more like spiritual version of living surrounded by these beautiful mountains, and yet it just kind of runs in the background. It's like, well, yeah. Yeah, God loves me. Yeah, Jesus came, died for my sins. Yeah, I'm a son of God made in His image. Yeah, I'm a daughter of God made in his image. Of course, he's coming back again. Of course, I'm going to get to be with him forever. It's like, just becomes this like, duh, you know, like the mountains. Yeah. And I've been thinking about that lately, of like the, how much I don't want to do that. Like how much I don't want to become so familiar with the gospel that it stops moving me. And I think that Lent is a helpful thing in that regard. That if there is any part of us that has lost the beauty of Easter, that Lent helps us recapture that a little bit. That's, I think, part of the wisdom of the early church fathers and mothers creating this like thing and pulling these things together. And I'm so glad that it's stuck around. And even though it isn't practiced exactly the same way everywhere, and it's got some weird elements to it, there is a purity, I think, that's there. And I think that that's like a part of what we're trying to hold on to. And so our staff, as we got into the start of the year, we started to look ahead to Lent, and we're having conversations, and they're kind of, we're in different places, but kind of the same. For one of us, it's how distracting life can be, that we've kind of lost the beauty of the mountains, perhaps because we're just so busy with our to-do lists and the demands of life and trying to get this, that we just kind of forget. Or it could be that we're just so comfortable, you know, that the cost is very low for us. And so maybe our comfort has kind of led to that. And I think one of the things that I keep thinking about is like in the prodigal son story, is like we really want to not be the younger son who rebels and lives, like goes and like takes his inheritance and squanders it and does all this kind of stuff and has this painful moment where he has to come back home and ask his dad, like, can I come back kind of thing. So we're trying to not be that rebellious, sinful, like whatever person. And but it's like, how do you not be the younger son without accidentally becoming the older son, who was this like kind of entitled spoiled brat a little bit, you know? Both sons had lost sight of the character of the father. And so if we're working to not be the younger one, we have to also work to not become the older one. And so that is how we have been praying and planning for Lent. And so I was thinking about that, all of those things together. And I was going back to that story with the mountains. And so I just started to ask myself, like, so what would, if for some reason I'm talking to those residents in La Madrid and it's really important to me that they love the mountains, you know, what would I do? How would you recapture the beauty of the mountains? And the only thing I was like, I would just tell them to sit and stare at the mountains. And to tell God everything that they're thinking and to thank him for the beauty of the creation. But you got to sit and just stare at it. And so what I want to do for the next 4 Sundays is sit and stare at a passage, the same passage every week in Isaiah 6. We'll emphasize different points of it and kind of move our way through it. But so for the next 4 Sundays, we're going to be in Isaiah 6, 1-8. With the heart behind it being like, we're just going to stare at the mountains. And if any of us have lost sight of the beauty of the gospel and the magnificence of God, if we become distracted or too comfortable or what, if just too familiar, that God would meet us in the staring as we begin to realize maybe that we've drifted a bit. I'm not trying to put this on you. You might be like, I never lost sight of the beauty of those mountains. And I hope that that's true. But probably in a church of this size, probably there's all over the spectrum a little bit. And Lent has a way, I think, of kind of, hey, let's like realign it. So let me read Isaiah 6, 1-8. In the year that King Uzziah died, I saw the Lord sitting upon a throne, high and lifted up, and the train of his robe filled the temple. Above him stood the seraphim. Each had 6 wings. With 2 he covered his face, with 2 he covered his feet, and with 2 he flew. And one called to another and said, Holy, holy, holy is the Lord of hosts. The whole earth is full of his glory. And the foundations of the threshold shook at the voice of him who called, and the house was filled with smoke. And I said, woe is me, for I am lost. I am a man of unclean lips, and I dwell in the midst of a people of unclean lips, for my eyes have seen the King, the Lord of hosts. And then one of the seraphim flew to me, having in his hand a burning coal that he had taken with tongs from the altar. And he touched my mouth and said, behold, this has touched your lips. Your guilt is taken away and your sin atoned for. And I heard the voice of the Lord saying, whom shall I send and who will go for us? And I said, here I am, send me. So this will be home for a couple of weeks. Let's walk through it. The first couple of verses. Verse 1 says, in the year that King Uzziah died, I saw the Lord sitting on a throne, high and lifted up, and the train of his robe filled the temple. Now, this verse has a lot. Every verse has a lot. And a part of what we need to try to do is envision what Isaiah is seeing. And so the reference to King Uzziah dying, that's more of a, it's kind of like if I was to say, during the COVID year, blah, 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 right? I don't have to say 2020. You know, you remember the COVID year. Or if I was like, man, that Christmas, the Christmas after the flood, that was a weird, weird season for us. And all of you who lived in Baton Rouge during that time are going to be like, yep. You know, I don't have to tell you that it was 2016. I just need to reference the thing that happened. And so this really is not about King Uzziah. It's more just saying that that was a significant year. And during that year, Isaiah, as a prophet, is saying, I had this vision. And so the imagery is very, it's obviously very royal, right? I saw the Lord sitting upon a throne, high and lifted up. The train of his robe filled the temple. So this is a peek into somewhere. Now, some people will take the word, they'll say temple, and they'll think it's talking about the temple in Jerusalem. But most scholars are like, no, this is not, like there wasn't a throne in the temple of Jerusalem. Most scholars would look at this and say, no, this is like, it's like God pulled back the curtain of heaven and allowed his prophet to see this, like the royal imagery of the throne room that's there. And most believe that this word Lord is a title and that Isaiah is seeing Jesus sitting on the throne. He doesn't know that it's Jesus necessarily, but that title is kind of what's going on here. And so if we're trying to get the vision, if we're trying to stare at the right thing, he sees Jesus sitting on a throne. The throne is up high. So he's looking up and that the train of his robe like fills the temple. And so he's wearing some kind of royal robe, which is what kings would wear back then. But the idea is like this robe just keeps going and going and going. Like it fills the whole room. So what's being described here is like the most majestic image that you could really imagine, you know, like we see, you know, pageantry and stuff like that, in this really like the royal family, that's like the closest we get now of like, what a big deal those things are. But, the train of their robes or dresses is long, but we're talking about like fills the entire space. And so he's looking at this, peeking into heaven. And so we have that part of it, but then look at verse 2. This is where it gets mysterious, because that much you're like, yeah, I feel like I've seen that in movies, but just take that and like, it's way, way, way more. Verse 2 says this, above him stood the seraphim. Each had six wings. With two, he covered his face. Two, he covered his feet. With two, he flew. Okay, so within the angelic host, you have cherubim, which is what we think of in terms of typically with angels. Seraphim are just a different creature completely. And the root word there, interestingly enough, is this word for snake or serpent. So it's like there's some kind of flying serpent creature, something. Don't really know. If you jump into Revelation 4, it's this very similar scene that's described. And they're the seraphim. In that vision, they have one has the head of a lion, one has the head of an eagle, you know, those kinds of things. So, like, there's something about the created angelic realm where they kind of look like animals, apparently. Or maybe that's just the closest word he could find. We don't really know. So you have this, like, this creature with six wings, and it's interesting of, like, I mean, if I had six wings, I'd just be flying, you know? Two of the wings are used for flight, but two wings are used to cover his face, and two covered his feet. Those are two, like, very important details. The covering of feet in the Old Testament has to do with humility. And so you might remember when Moses sees the shrub that's on fire and God begins to speak to him and he says, take your shoes off, dude. This ground is holy. And so the feet were like kind of a part of things. And so to cover the feet was an act of submission and humility. To cover the eyes, the scholars look at that and they're like, that doesn't make a lot of sense until you get to the next verse. Verse 3. One called to another and said, holy, holy, holy is the Lord of hosts. The whole earth is full of his glory. So two important terms that we use in church a lot and in our songs and in our prayers, but do we always know what they mean exactly? Well, let's try to remedy that just in case. So the first one would be holy. The second one will be glory. We'll look at those two. So the idea of the word for holy, sometimes we think of it in certain ways. It really doesn't matter how we think of it. It matters how does the Bible use it. And the primary way that the Bible uses the word holy is in a way that is talking about the uniqueness of God, of that God is unlike anything else in creation, that God is set apart in those ways. And he's unlike anything else, set apart from everything else, just completely unique. So sometimes we think of it in more like a moral sense, but the primary sense is like, yeah, there's no category to put him in. He's in his own category. And that kind of has two sub-layers to it. One, he's holy in terms of creation. Like he's unique in creation, that there's nothing else like him. And so the trees are not like God. The mountains are not like God. The Jupiter is not like God. Like there's no comparison. The closest is humans. We're made in his image, but he's still distinct from us. And so holy in terms of like unique and set apart from creation, but also unique and set apart from how sin has impacted creation. And so sin and death enter the world through the rebellion of humanity, and that's why everything is broken here. That's why we fight each other. That's why we are apparently now in a new conflict, you know? Like those kinds of like wars, and there's violence, and there's like all those kinds of problems. That's why abuse happens. That's why we get sick, and that's why we grow old, and we die, and that's why we have earthquakes and hurricanes, and like everything is affected by that. Humans, the entire created order, everything has been impacted by sin. And There's nothing in creation that has been unaffected, some more severely than others. Some aspects are more clearly seen than others, but sin has permeated and worked its way through everything in creation. No one escapes it. No thing escapes it. And yet God is holy from all that. So he has not been corrupted by sin and death the way that we have. It has affected him relationally because his image bearers are broken. His sons and his daughters are pitted against one another. It fractured relationship with him, with ourselves, with one another, with creation, like all that kind of stuff. So it has affected him in the emotional, relational kind of sense, but it has not affected his character in any way. He's holy and separate from all of that. And so these seraphim are flying around and they're declaring this. And they don't just say he's holy. They say he's holy, holy, holy. That there's three of them. There's nothing else in the Bible that describes God three times. This is the one. That this is the primary descriptor and explanation of God that the Bible wants us to take away. And I listened to quite a few sermons on this, and R.C. Sproul talks about that, about how God is love, but the seraphim are not saying love, love, love. Not that love is unimportant, but it comes from his holiness. And Sproul points this out, and I don't think I've ever heard this before, but how in the Bible, when something is repeated, it's kind of like if we are trying to send an email, or you're trying to put something together and you're like, I really want this to stand out, so I'm going to highlight it, I'm going to bold it, you know? I'm going to underline it, I'm going to increase the font, I'm going to make sure that you know of all this paragraph, this is the main thing I want you to know. That the biblical writers, the way that they did that was to repeat things. And so if this is the only one that happens three times, it's the scripture's way of saying, pay attention to this thing. That we, in our brokenness and in our broken world, are having a hard time understanding God thoroughly. And so God pulls the curtain back and lets Isaiah be like, oh, that's what's going on. That the angels are declaring to one another the holiness of God so much that they have to say it three times. And so the covering of the feet, if that is an act of humility and submission, that's what these creatures are doing. They're humbling themselves because the awesomeness of God's holiness is apparently overwhelming to them. And even down to covering the face, what's the thing there? Well, what do you think it is? You ever been in that place where the holiness and majesty of God is so much and you're just like, I just don't know what to do. You know what I mean? Jesus is described as someone from whom men hid their faces. Could it be that the holiness, the separation from him and the unaffected by sin part of him, that he shined so brightly that it made them feel like Isaiah, like, woe is me. I don't even want to look at you. Remember when Peter responded that way? Jesus calms a storm and he's like, depart from me. That these creatures who are in the throne room, that they have not lost sight of the beauty of the mountains. They are like covering their faces, declaring it with their mouths, humbling themselves, covering their feet. That is the response in the throne room. They have not gotten over it yet. They haven't gotten used to it yet. It says in Revelation 4, very similar passage, that they just repeat it over and over and over and over and over again. They just can't stop. Let me read to you from Revelation 4. So instead of Isaiah's vision, this is John's vision. You don't need to turn to it. It says, "At once I was in the Spirit, and behold, a throne stood in heaven with one seated on the throne." Okay, so far we're tracking. Verse 3, "He who sat there had the appearance of jasper and carnelian, and around the throne was a rainbow that had an appearance of an emerald." Okay, very much tracking the same thing. Verse 8, "The four living creatures, each of them with six wings, are full of eyes all around and within. And day and night they never cease to say, 'Holy, holy, holy is the Lord God Almighty, who was and is to come.'" So Isaiah sees it. John sees it. Same thing. That what's happening in heaven at this moment is that all the created beings are just declaring the holiness of God over and over and over and over, and they're not tired of it. It's not become too familiar. They haven't become distracted. They haven't become too comfortable. They just are like overwhelmed with it. That the holiness of God, that's the starting point of worship. I've repeated this for a long time, and now I will never repeat it again. The definition of worship that I heard when I was younger and have tracked it the whole time, it's giving God glory for who he is and what he has done. Now, I think the first part of that is enough. It's who he is. Like that, it's not for just what he's done. The starting point is holiness. The fact that from his holiness, he rescued us, like that's bonus. And in fact, like that is how we know who he is. And so he's worthy of it, regardless of it, if he's done anything for us. It's just, it's who he is. And so like with human beings, what we bring to the table as the starting point for us being worthy of dignity and respect is the fact that everyone is made in God's image. Like that is the starting point. And from there, like life, humanity kind of morphs and evolves, you know. But that's the starting point for every human. And that's where we're trying to get more and more ingrained into us of the value and worth of every person. It's because they're made in his image. That's the core of what gives you value. The core of what gives God value is holiness. That even if he had not done a single thing for us, that we as his creation should still declare the glory and wonders of God. And so if we're going to journey through Isaiah 6 for a couple of weeks, we have to make sure that the starting point, the focal point, is him and his holiness, not all the ways that we have benefited from what he's done. Even though that's super important and of course it's valuable. Of course, all those kinds of things. I'm not trying to scrap any of that stuff, but I'm saying that the beginning point of everything else is to be kind of stunned in that way, like we see here. And then, verse 3, they declare the holiness of God, and then they say, "The earth, the whole earth is full of his glory." So there's another word that we use a lot. Glory, the biblical word, it basically means like the weightiness of his holiness in our presence. I don't know if you've ever been in a room where someone who was like very important or powerful like walked in and kind of felt the temperature of the room change. I was trying to think through my own experiences if I have ever like done that, been in a situation like that before, and I don't really know, but I was hoping to have a better story right there. but you think about that, like if we were sitting here right now, and LeBron James walked in the door, I don't know why I picked him. LeBron James walks in, this section over here would be very excited. But like, you'd be like, oh, I'm in the same room as LeBron James, the second greatest player of all time. So, distraction, all right. But it's like when you're in the, someone's in the room, and like, it's like there's like a weightiness, like everyone's kind of sitting up a little taller, and you're kind of revolving around that. That has a glimpse of glory to it, where you feel like the weight of someone's presence in the room, like the whole vibe changes in those moments. And so the glory of God is what we see in the Old Testament, where Israel is there, and Israel is like, they've left Egypt, and they're going to the promised land, and they're like, we don't know what to do. And God's like, okay, how about this? I'm gonna take my glory into the physical presence of a cloud. So the weightiness of my presence with you, it's too vague. I'm gonna manifest it physically in this cloud. And I'm gonna guide you, and you're gonna follow that cloud. And when it moves, you move. And when it stops, you stop. And that's how you're gonna know I'm with you. And I'm like, what about at night? All right, it'll be a pillar of fire at night, cloud during the day. It's the manifestation of God's holiness, but the weight of that takes form somehow. And we see them build the tabernacle, and that cloud comes down, surrounds the tabernacle, and goes into it and fills the tabernacle up. And so God is saying, you want to know like that I'm with you. It's going to become tangible and measurable. And we see the weight of his presence in those that sort of way. And so what the seraphim are saying is that the whole earth is full of his glory. In other words, everything that you see is pointing to him. We don't have a cloud. We don't have a pillar of fire. We don't have a temple that we go to. And we're like, God's in that building right there. They're saying, no. If you will just see it the way we see it, everything is pointing to the fact that God is with us. All of the trees, all of the ocean, all of the stars, all of the mountains, all of the humans are pointing to something. The whole earth is full of his glory. So the seraphim are saying this. And then verse 4, the foundations of the thresholds shook at the voice of him who called, and the house was filled with smoke. Smoke was affiliated with God's presence. The foundations and the thresholds, it's saying like the slab of the building and the doorposts of the building, everything began to shake at his voice. They're saying, holy, holy, holy is the Lord of hosts. The whole earth is full of his glory, and everything begins to rattle. It's stunning. Just a stunning picture. And so what do we do with that much of Isaiah 6? Well, I think there's something to be learned in, pull back the curtain, Isaiah sees this happening, and everything has to respond to that. Like, that's not of like, that's an interesting thing that I will try to keep in mind from now on. It's like, no. Like, you have to respond to it. We see a couple of responses. One, we see the building shake. Okay, in other words, the whole created order shakes. The response of everything that God spoke into existence. You know, everything that you see around you right now comes from like the speaking of God into existence. Yeah, all of it. That anywhere you go around the earth, every building, every car, every human, all comes back from God saying, let there be light. And so the created order is responding, sometimes saying no, sometimes saying yes. So the created order responds. The seraphim, they respond. How do they respond? They submit and humble themselves by covering their feet. They don't want to look directly at his holiness is so amazing, they have to cover their eyes, but with their mouths, they're declaring it. So they're humbling themselves and they're proclaiming it, what they see. Isaiah has a response. Look at verse 5. His response is this: woe is me, for I am lost. I'm a man of unclean lips, and I dwell in the midst of people with unclean lips, for my eyes have seen the King, the Lord of hosts. That as he sees the holiness of God, and the doorposts and the foundations are shaking, and the seraphim are humbling themselves and not looking directly at God because they're so overwhelmed, but they're just declaring his holiness. They're declaring what they're seeing. That's their response. And he's just like, I am ruined by what I see. How in the world can I be in the presence? It's like he's, and I saw this a couple of times when I was researching, and it's like he was afraid and terrified because he knows how messed up he is, and he knows the purity and the awesomeness and the holiness of God. He's like, if I get too close to that, I am done. In Revelation 4, I read that a few minutes ago. Here's how the elders in that scene, here's how they responded. It says that there are 24 elders. We don't really know who they are, but this is what it says about them. It says, whenever the living creatures give glory and honor and thanks to him who's seated on the throne, who lives forever and ever, the 24 elders fall down before him who's seated on the throne and worship him who lives forever and ever. And they cast their crowns before the throne, saying, worthy are you, our Lord and God, to receive glory and honor and power, for you created all things, and by your will they existed and were created. That the holiness of God evokes this response where they fall down and they begin to glorify him and to thank him, and they take whatever the crowns are, whatever these things are, and they like throw them at his feet of like, this is nothing. You are worthy of everything that I have. It's like when we see the holiness of God, when God allows us those glimpses of who he is, what's your response to that? I tell you this, you're not going to stand there with your hands in your pockets. You're not going to sit there and check your watch to wonder how long the sermon's going to go and what time, if you're going to be able to get out of here on time. Like, those things don't happen. And I don't say that as an accusation. I'm saying like when we see it, you have to do something with it. And if there's any part of us that everything has become too familiar, we're missing this. We're missing him. And it's difficult, you know? It's difficult to like to grasp it and to understand it. Isaiah is a prophet, and until this moment, he really hadn't gotten it this way. And then he's not the same afterwards. And so I'm not trying to point us toward like some sort of standard response. I think the interesting thing in those stories is like there's just different responses happening. But there's a part of us that needs to respond like creation does, to like shake in response to God showing us things and telling us who he is. There's a part of you that's like, I'm moved by that. There's something like literally like vibrating inside of me because I'm resonating with what God is doing in this moment. That there has to be times when we are also covering our feet, we're submitting to him and humbling ourselves. That is a response. There are times where we cover our faces and we're like, I can't even look you in the face because of how beautiful you are. And there's a part of us that has to have a little bit of that, woe is me. I'm bringing uncleanness into this. There has to be a part of us, how he says, I'm among a people of unclean lips, so for us to say, not only am I bringing like sin into this, but we as humans, the human race, like I'm here to represent the human race to say we are messing this up. There have to be times when we're like the elders in the story where we are bowing and we're taking our crowns down and we're saying, here's all my human accomplishment. Here's all the things that I hang my hat on. Here are all the ways I find my security and my comfort. And like, here's all of it. Just take it all because I've seen you and your worth. And all I want to do is just give everything back to you in this moment. And so if you are ever in situations where you're gathered with God's people and you're just kind of bored, we have to be with it in the moment to be like, hey, I need to dial into heaven right now. And it's not the exclusive job of anyone who's up here giving leadership to coax you into that, right? Like you come to the table. You show up with the bar set high, and hopefully there's good leadership being given to whatever gatherings that we're in. And hopefully that's happening. And sometimes we need someone to grab us like a shepherd's crook and like pull us in a little bit more. Sometimes we need that realignment and that leadership. But I want to encourage you, like, do you show up ready for this? I hope so. When it's time for the saints to gather, these are the images that we're trying to regain. We're trying to go to the edge of the town and sit down and look at the mountains together. And we show up ready for that. It's one of the things from being in India, and I was telling Meg this yesterday, like I don't want to try to like expect the same things here as there. But I do want to be challenged by the things there that I need to be challenged by. And there comes this part of the pastor's conference where on the Sunday morning, they start off grouped up by languages. And so there are like these big sessions where it's being translated into one other language, but there are five different languages that are spoken. And so they let you get in groups and it's just a communion service. And the most like humbling thing in the world is when it's time to serve communion is to walk up to people who have taken their shoes off and they're sitting on the ground and they've brought a Bible and they're not putting their Bible on the ground, but they're holding it. They don't let it touch the ground. And you are walking around, and like this time I had a tray of bread, and I'm walking around to people, and I'm saying, the body of Christ broken for you. And they look up, and they are just weeping. And not just like, oh, here's an emotionally charged person. Let me move to someone else. It's like person after person after person. So moved. And the thing is, prior to that, there wasn't this like emotional appeal. It wasn't this like big, like, let's just get you all stirred up. Everyone's crying. Okay, now it's like youth camp last night. Okay, everyone's pumped. Now let's serve you communion. It's just, we read the scriptures. We prayed. We go to serve it. And in those moments, I was like, oh, you know the beauty of the mountain. And you know the beauty of the mountain. And you know the beauty of the mountain. And I'm walking around serving. I'm like, I don't think I know the beauty of the mountain. And they're listening to us, these like American pastors. And what we all talk about among ourselves is like, we come here to learn from them. They don't come here and learn from us. I think that what God is doing in our here, Living Hope among us, is I think in the gathering, whether it's here on Sundays or in community groups, or when we share meals with each other and we get coffee together and just living life together, I think it's supposed to be continuing to pull the curtain back, helping us make sure we don't get so used to the gospel that we're not moved by it anymore. That when we're singing songs and the lyrics are talking about God being holy, that we're not bored. That when we approach the communion table, we're recognizing the sacredness of everything that's going on, and that the holy creator of the universe is holding out to us the body and blood. If you remember the text, Isaiah steps away. He says, "Woe is me." And the seraphim comes to him and brings him a coal and touches his lips. And what do we do in communion? It touches our lips, right? Like, it's this amazing, amazing interaction that happens here in Isaiah that we get to like duplicate that over and over again. We just need to be in touch with the fact that when something is repetitive, it can become familiar. It doesn't have to be. I'm not saying that it has become that. I'm just asking you to ask the Lord, have I lived among the beauty so much that it's just in the background? Have I been trying to not be the younger son so much that I've become the older son? Can I respond in such a way that the foundations and doorposts of my life shake at what he is doing? And it leads to the humility and the worship and the praise and the kind of stepping back, but also the recognition that you have come to me and I want to cast my crowns down before you. Like, is that happening when we are together? And is it happening when we are apart? Is that just the way that we learn to live our lives? I'm asking God to help me and to help us in all of these ways. And so in just a minute, we're going to go through our normal like time of response, but we're going to do it just a little bit differently. We're going to sing a little bit first before the communion table is open. And I want to encourage you as we sing, I don't want you to just sing, you know? I want us to join the seraphim. I want us to join the elders in Revelation. Like, I want us to join Isaiah in this. And these will be songs that you know, probably. But don't let the familiarity, I can't say that word. Don't let it be so familiar that you're just kind of singing along. That God can maybe pull the curtain back for us too a little bit more today. After we sing a little bit, then we'll open up the tables and we'll continue to sing and we'll take the meal of heaven together, and then we'll be launched back out. So if you would stand as our musicians come back. Let me pray for us. God, I thank you for this like moment that Isaiah had with you, and for your leadership of his life as your son and also as one of your prophets. Thank you for empowering him and helping him write down what he saw, and for preserving it all these years so that we could be here today reading it and being blessed by it and being challenged by it and being maybe even inspired a bit. And so, Lord, I'm sure that there are some in the room who have not lost sight of the beauty of the mountains, and I don't want to try to convince anyone otherwise, but perhaps to varying degrees, maybe we've just been around it so much that maybe we're not as moved, not as responsive, and maybe we just don't think about it. And so would you empower us? Would you help us to do what we can't do on our own? Give us the grace to soak up the goodness this morning that you have for us that comes out of your word and out of the togetherness of your people. And so help us as we continue to respond. Would you shake the doorposts and foundations of us? Would you help us to submit and be humble and to proclaim holiness with our mouths? Would you help us to recognize what we bring to the table and then also the fact that you have met us in that to the point where it makes us bow and cast our crowns down. Help us as we just sit and stare at your holiness for a few minutes, and prepare us to approach the table.